KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Each one of those breasts is about 6 pounds, so that's 12 pounds there. Then I've got a rubber behind that's probably, 6 or 7 pounds. And then I have two hips, which are basically foam, so they're not bad.
That is the unmistakable voice of Broadway playwright and star Harvey Fierstein, who is reprising his Tony-winning performance as Big Mama Edna Turnblad for NBC's upcoming live production of Hairspray. Fierstein also wrote the teleplay. We visit the set where Fierstein tells us about the heavy task of transforming himself into Edna and about some of the changes he made to take the script from Broadway to live TV. But first on the News Banter, a Hollywood money man goes from big losses in Relativity Media to a cabinet appointment in the Trump administration. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my buddy in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So as you know, Steven Mnuchin, who was known in this town as a money man, an investor who comes in and gives millions of dollars for films to be made, he had been established here as that, and among other things, and he is now Donald Trump's selection to be Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah, it's a pretty stunning turn of events for a guy who's been pretty under the radar in Hollywood, although he has put hundreds of millions of dollars into films going all the way back to 2005 when he invested in the Fox slate, which included the X-Men movies and Avatar and a bunch of others. That deal ended in 2012, but in the meantime, he had really expanded his purview in LA and into other areas as well.
Yes, he led a group of investors in the purchase of IndyMac, which was a notorious failed lender. In the middle of the financial crisis, of course, when the housing bubble burst, it turned out that IndyMac had a ton of bad loans, and it was in desperate trouble. Steve Mnuchin led a group of investors to buy it. A lot of people complained it was a sweetheart deal with the government taking most of the risk, but nonetheless, they bought it. He became chairman of it. He renamed it One West. And in that capacity, One West loaned money to Ryan Kavanaugh's Relativity. Now, you know and I know, Matt, Ryan Kavanaugh has a reputation as a high-flying guy. Relativity has been through the constant financial turmoil for the last, I don't know how many years. Steve Mnuchin invested through his hedge fund that was backing movies, which is called Dune Capital. His bank loaned tens of millions of dollars to Relativity. And ultimately, Steve Mnuchin became co-chairman of Relativity. And again, saying we're going to take Relativity Media, this troubled company, public, citing the success of Ryan Kavanaugh. I think a lot of people in Hollywood did not know what success he was talking about.
Yes, and it soon went pretty badly for Relativity, for One West, and for Mnuchin personally. I mean, the studio went bankrupt. Mnuchin stepped down as co-chairman weeks before that bankruptcy. He took a lot of the One West money out of Relativity. And at some point, Kavanaugh even blamed One West and Mnuchin for pushing the company into bankruptcy, although Kavanaugh still says they're friends, weirdly. But that investment did not go well for him.
Yeah, One West pulled out about $50 million in the weeks leading up to this bankruptcy. And Ryan Kavanaugh did believe that that was Steve Mnuchin and the bank's fault. Meanwhile, Steve Mnuchin's Dune and his personal investment was said to be gone, tens of millions of dollars. And One West, which was subsequently acquired itself, still is listed as a major creditor for tens of millions of dollars from Relativity. So that was pretty much a debacle. If he has hearings before the Senate to be confirmed, he'll be boasting about the brilliant investment in Relativity or the strangeness of simultaneously being chairman of One West Bank and co-chairman of Relativity during this turbulent period.
No, and at the time, as you reported in an interesting feature in Hollywood Reporter this week, he had sort of, quote-unquote, gone Hollywood. Gone was the very conservative Goldman Sachs banker, and all of a sudden he co-owned a jet with Ryan Kavanaugh. He was one of those guys who you would see out on the circuit. He was at Cannes, very much a more Hollywood lifestyle. Now, he subsequently has created a new investment fund with Brett Ratner, the filmmaker, and James Packer, the Australian billionaire. They together have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in the Warner Brothers film slate. And that is an investment that I believe is still playing out because they have had hits like Gravity, a couple others. They have also had some big flops like Pan and Jupiter Ascending. They are not invested in the Fantastic Beasts movies from Warners that seem to be doing well. So the question is whether the investment in Warner Brothers is going to turn out like the Fox investment, which seemed to do well, or whether it's going to turn out like Relativity, which went horribly wrong.
Certainly, it's already been somewhat renegotiated because it wasn't going well, but maybe it's improved. Steven Mnuchin may very well be off in Washington, and somebody else will have to figure that one out. Let me just turn to another big story this week. The television critics have a twice-a-year meeting, so normally that takes place in January, and it will. But this year, the big four networks have decided for the first time that their executives will not appear and answer questions from TV critics and TV journalists. And this is not welcome at all from the standpoint of the critics. Tim Goodman, our critic at The Hollywood Reporter, said this was they were simply trying to protect these executives because they don't want to be questioned about the fact that their networks have had a dismal fall. And we know that model is challenged.
Goodman called them cowardly. And I think as a TCA member, he's rightly upset that these people who, you know, at least are have been forced to face the press twice a year to answer questions are no longer willing to do that. But it's a larger issue because, you know, Netflix and Amazon are skipping the January TCA entirely. So I think it's more reflection here on the changing nature of media. There was a time when the winter and summer press tours meant a lot for the coverage cycle in the television industry, where you would go twice a year and reporters from all over the world would come and they could bank interviews with stars and they could hear about the latest projects and the strategies from the networks. And it was really a more of an informational thing. Now, with the internet and with everybody posting immediately and these firing squad questions being asked of the talent and the executives, I think they finally just said, you know, enough is enough. They don't want to subject their executives to this.
I mean, on the one hand, I think you're right. These executives don't like being in a room with a bunch of critics who are tweeting. And Preston Beckman, who's the retired head of scheduling at Fox for many years, he said it's like a firing squad and these writers are all trying to be clever and impress each other. And there isn't a thoughtful thing anymore. However, when you asked critics, you know, when you want your stuff to be publicized by all of these different outlets, it doesn't seem unreasonable that you should come and talk about how your business is doing. And I think a lot of critics feel that way. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Just a quick update after we taped, Fox backtracked on their decision and announced that their executives will attend the January press tour. In a statement, Fox said it had heard from many critics in the past week, and it turned out the network had underestimated the interest in the panel. At this point, we don't know if the other networks will follow suit. In a corner of the NBC backlot, a generic city street set has been transformed into 1960s Baltimore for the upcoming production of Hairspray Live, airing on December 7th. Signs on the shops, Divine Pet Food and Greenblatt's Baltimore Crabs, are nods to the industry, the former to the iconic Divine, who played Edna Turnblad in the 1988 John Waters movie Hairspray. And of course, Bob Greenblatt is the chairman of NBC Entertainment. Hairspray tells the story of Baltimore teenager Tracy Turnblad, played in NBC's production by newcomer Maddie Baglio. Tracy has been told she's too fat to realize her dream of dancing on the Corny Collins TV show. Her quest to perform turns into a crusade against segregation. The cast of this lavish NBC production includes Martin Short, Kristen Chenoweth, and Jennifer Hudson. The director is Tony winner Kenny Leon, and playing Tracy's mother, Edna, is Harvey Fierstein, who won a Tony for performing the role on Broadway. Fierstein has also won Tonys for his play, Torch Song Trilogy, and for writing the book for the stage version of La Cage aux Folles. I should disclose that Harvey has been a kind and supportive friend of mine for many years. In Hairspray, Edna goes through an evolution of her own, getting a makeover during the song Welcome to the 60s. Which is the number the cast was rehearsing the day we were on the set.
You guys, here we go. If you're in Welcome to the 60s, here we go. From the top.
By the time the show goes live, it'll probably sound more like this.
Yes, I know that the world's been passed out. Tell all the creature to step aside. Your mama's welcome in the 60s.
While Hairspray welcomes viewers to the 1960s, its themes of fighting bigotry still feel very relevant today. We talked to Feierstein in his trailer just a few days after this year's presidential election, which had left many in Hollywood deeply upset. I asked Feierstein whether that was affecting rehearsals.
Of course, but these are kids, you have to think. And that's who I felt for immediately. I thought, if I was that 18-year-old kid and the last 8 years of my life I had a black president, I mean, we have an 11-year-old in the cast. So they're having this moment, but they're depressed and they're angry, but they don't seem to be as depressed and angry as we who know what it's actually going to be like. They hear those words, repeal Obamacare. They don't know what that means yet. I'm thinking, but yes, there's a lot of depression. But we also think to ourselves, you know, here we are, we're in a room, we're doing a show about segregation.
Exactly what I was going to say next, yeah.
And we've got Kenny Leon directing us. And Kenny Leon is someone, you know, I'm an atheist, but I do appreciate what people really believe. And he's a real true believer. And he comes out of that tradition of the church of everything happens for a reason and that we rise above. And, you know, that great spiritual belief that we fight on. And so it's great to be around someone like that when something like this happens. And it gave us a purpose. And it filled that room with purpose. So, you know, I was sending things to Jennifer Hudson, like, you know, because Jennifer Hudson's playing Motormouth Mabel in this version. And Motormouth is a black woman who works at the TV station, but only one day a month. They have Negro Day. And the rest of the time she has a little record shop and she's a DJ. And she's a woman who has all this history with these, before these kids, and she's the one who explains life to the children, and she has this big number, I Know Where I've Been, and so I sent this Donna Brazile quote to her. What got people angry wasn't that I got through the door, it's that I held the door open and said, come on in, and they needed to hear that. She needed to hear that, and they're now going to learn that lesson, and they're going to feel that delivering this message.
You originated Edna on Broadway.
Yes.
I came to see you.
Yes, you did.
It was fun. And then you're doing it for TV, and you're rewriting it.
Right.
Because it has to be rewritten? You can't just do Broadway Hairspray.
No, you can't.
Hairspray.
You can't. Well, first of all, there's commercials. You know, you don't get no commercials on Broadway.
No.
And you have that 15-minute intermission on Broadway, which you don't have.
Right.
So structurally, it's different. But I don't even know. Do you not know that I actually ghostwrote Hairspray?
The original? Original?
Yeah, the original.
I did not know that you ghostwrote.
I didn't put my name on it, but I get paid for it.
So, that's the important
thing. So I was actually always one of the writers. So it's nothing strange about my writing Hairspray. And I edited the script down when we did the Las Vegas version, and I wrote a different version for the Hollywood Bowl. So this was the third time that I was actually asked to rewrite Hairspray altogether. And, you know, I wrote The Wiz last year. So when they came to me and asked me to do it, I said, sure. And the thing is, you know, I learned it obviously doing The Wiz was, you know, you have to have this long first act to get the audience involved, and then you do this stuff. So I knew how to structure it. So I had to do some structural stuff there. Also, I knew that it didn't make sense. One of my favorite numbers on stage is that big number that all the women do behind bars. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all carrying around our jail bars. But that's really after intermission to remind the audience of where we are. We don't have an intermission, so we didn't need that. I knew that it would waste a lot of money changing everybody's clothes, putting us all in tap shoes, even though it's my one time to tap on TV. I'll never get another chance to tap on TV.
Maybe you will.
So I took that out. But also because Kenny was doing it, and because we're a little further down the line, I thought, here's my chance to do a couple of little things. In the original, there's a line, when Tracy breaks out of jail, you hear a television voice, which Billy Eichner is playing the television reporter, and he says, you know, Tracy's broken out of jail. If you spot her, call the police. If no phone line is available, shoot to kill, and then goes on with the news. And so I changed it to shoot to kill. That's what we do.
Oh, you know, little shot there.
Link, when he says that he can't throw away his career helping these kids desegregate, I had a line for him: I'm not throwing away my shot, which is my little nod to Hamilton. The censors made me take out something, and I replaced it with, oh no, a black boy has got my daughter. Do I call the chief of police or the grand wizard?
Ooh, that's feeling very potentially apropos right now.
Well, you know, exactly. So, but the bigger thing, not the jokey thing, is that when they call it Negro Day, there was never, not in the original movie, not in the prestige show, there was no reaction from the African-American cast to Negro Day. And I said that, you know, that's always bothered me. And so I said, now I can do something about it because I was in charge.
You're in charge.
Oh, and so when she says, you know, oh, Negro Day is my favorite day, you know, the cast moans. And she says, did I say something wrong? And he says, we appreciate the attention, but we could do without the nomenclature. And sort of tries to explain to her that. And she keeps saying Negro Day, and it keeps getting. So there was an innocence that was too innocent in the original that I think we can nicely now grow up.
Yes. Now, I'm wondering, have you been watching these productions? Like, NBC did various ones of Sound of Music, yeah. Peter Pan, Grease, yeah, Live on Fox.
You have to watch them. You have to watch them. We have to support this new art form because, I mean, it was an old art form, you know, because they used to do these live musicals and they used to do live television, but we sort of forgot how to do that. And audiences forgot how to make believe. You know, you're so used to. I always say the difference between theater and movies is you go to the movies and you see this beautiful shot of the sand and, you know, and all that. And then it says, you know, then the Chiron comes up as if that wasn't enough and says the left bank of Paris, you know. But on stage, you can have an empty stage and a guy walks in and says, isn't a beautiful day on the sand? And the audience is with you. They don't need to see anything. This TV thing is somewhere in between and we're trying to figure it out. So with Sound of Music, they had sort of theatrical sets, which were a little clunky, like when she went wandering through the plastic woods.
Yes.
You know, it's a little clunky. Peter Pan is much more of a fantasy, so they went the fantasy world, but they stretched the show out in a way that was, but like I say, it's a growing pains. It's growing pains. Then on Grease, it was a different thing. On The Wiz, we did totally theatrically, but the idea behind The Wiz was we were going to take that production exactly as it was and 3 months later open it on Broadway. So exactly what you saw would have been what you saw. Cirque du Soleil did not go through because of the theater not being available or something like that. But anyway, we're still waiting for that. So on Hairspray, we made this decision to use a reality when we could. So we have this real Baltimore street, and we have real apartments like you would a movie set. But we also have this unreality, like when we're singing Mama, I'm a Big Girl Now, I'm in my daughter's bedroom and I'm yelling at her at the vanity. But then you realize there are two vanities on either side of her with two other mothers and daughters. And then it opens up and there's more girls and more girls and this wall flies out and there's all these girls and all these vanities. So it's like all of a sudden Busby Berkeley. So we have that musical thing also. And we'll see how that works. But it's always these are really growing experiences. But they're bringing an audience to Broadway and to musicals that might not have, you know, the joke has always been, what do we say, that, you know, the only gay people and old women go to musicals. But Hamilton and these musicals on TV are changing that.
Coming up after a short break, Harvey Fierstein walks us through the weighty business of transforming himself into Edna Turnblad. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer and actor Harvey Fierstein, who's written the teleplay for NBC's production of Hairspray, which airs live this Wednesday, December 7th. Fierstein reprises his role as protective mother Edna Turnblad, who in the second half of the show is despondent that her daughter Tracy remains in jail for protesting segregation on the Corny Collins TV dance show. Edna and her husband Wilbur, played in the NBC version by Martin Short, take comfort in their love for each other in the song You're Timeless to Me.
Fads keep a fading, Castro's invading, but Wilbur, you're timeless to me. Tattoos are higher, mine feels like barbed wire, but you say I'm chic as can be. You're like a rare vintage ripple, a vintage they'll never forget. So pour me a teeny-weeny triple, and we can toast the fact we ain't dead yet. I can't stop eating.
Before going to work on Hairspray, Fierstein wrote the teleplay for NBC's live musical version of The Wiz. He's observed how these productions are evolving as the form has enjoyed a recent renaissance. One change that started with Fox's award-winning production of Grease was the inclusion of a live audience.
Grease had people in the gymnasium, and they had people on the street, I think. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have them in the Corny Collins show, and we're going to have people not in the gym. I think in the Corny Collins show and then out on the street, I think, is how it works. So we're going to and last night, the two directors, Kenny and Alex, and I sat and we went through the script, and I was trying to, they wanted to know from me, because we haven't had a live audience at all, where the laughs were, where the surefire laughs were. So I was able to sort of give them and so we'll think about playing with a live audience reaction. We don't want it to sound like a...
canned.
Yeah. But then some of the people in Grease, when they did their performances, which I'm sure everybody in the rehearsal room laughed at, there was nobody laughing and they looked a little silly. It's like I say,
it's hard to predict when people
growing, laugh. Yeah, it's this growing.
It's a thing that's developing.
Yeah.
And then you go from a stage, which is a very confined space, to this wide, I mean, it must transform the choreography and all kinds of
it's
stuff.
Very, well, it's, at first I thought it was going to be, what my idea in my head was, it was going to be like doing theater in the round.
Oh,
you know, where you had to consider this audience all the way around you. But it's not.
No.
It's like this strange, you know, they do those videos now that are almost 3D where you like the video goes through. That's what it feels like. It's a very strange feeling. You're acting and you're playing and you're thinking the audience is here, but then you realize the camera is over there and right in your face. So you just have to be alive three-dimensionally. And then the choreography is a little easier because choreography is just staged.
Although, as I'm sure you already know, we talked about this once, the camera picks up everything. Like you have to give such a more dialed back performance when the camera's in your face.
I said to Kenny, after we did this run through, I said, Kenny, I'm really worried. And I said, I think that my performance is going to be too big. And he said, Harvey, believe me, I'm here. Denzel trusts me. You can trust me. You know, you can't exactly fight with that. So I said, okay, fine. So he's going to watch it for me, whatever. So the next day, Marty Short arrived. So there I am doing the same scenes instead of with, you know, with a dancer. I'm doing it with Marty Short. And we're laughing our heads off. And Kenny comes to me when the rehearsal's over and goes, Harvey, too big. So I yelled at Marty. I said, you got me yelled at. Got me in trouble with the principal. And it's only going to get worse now. Because now Andrea's arriving and Andrea Martin and Sean Hayes is arriving. These are all people I love playing with. So Rosie O'Donnell, Andrea and Rosie both played my wife, remember, in Fiddler on the Roof.
They were my wives.
Mm-hmm. Two of my wives.
Teddy's wives.
So, Edna's wives. See, I have gone lesbian before. So yeah. there's a definite thing. But, you know, Edna is a sort of force of nature, and I have to just trust that Edna will appear.
Now, I remember when you were on Broadway and I came, you took me backstage and you showed me the suit you had to wear, which was extraordinarily heavy, I think, I sort of felt it.
William and I, you know, developing the character, you go through a lot of mistakes and you go through a lot of stuff. So by the time we were all done, Edna was built on a corset, which strangely enough pulled me in, corseted me, and then had all this padding on the outside. So it tortured me, making me thinner while making me fatter.
That makes sense.
It made no sense. So I never questioned it because it was like too much trouble. And I wore it for 5 years. And then when we got to Hollywood Bowl, all of my stuff had gone to London and Michael Ball had worn it and he had everything cut up because he wanted to wear my things. You know, it's like, I want that dress. And so everything was ruined. And so we had to put stuff together. And I said, just give me a pair of panties and let's put a pillow. Let's just attach a pillow here, a pillow here. I had a bra. I had my same breasts, which were silicone breasts. That's why they're so heavy. They're actual replacement breasts. And so when we got here, we've done a version that's more like that. So
So you'll be lighter on your feet.
Well, each one of those breasts is about 6 pounds. So that's 12 pounds there. Then I've got a rubber behind that's probably, you know, 6 or 7 pounds. And then I have two hips, which are basically foam, so they're not bad. And sort of for the finale only, I put on a corset. One of those, you know, Miss Scarlet corsets, you know, with the strings in the back where they're pulling you and putting the foot against you.
So yeah, I'm wearing your eyes one of pop those. Out. Yeah.
So I mean, yeah. But my dress, my finale dress, I would say probably weighs about 20 pounds, 25 pounds. It can't hang. It just
lies on the floor.
Lies on the floor in its own little box.
And then
box.
The big wigs.
And then the wigs. The wigs don't weigh anything. Yeah. Though they don't weigh anything for a man. But, you know, several girls in Hairspray had neck damage from wearing those giant wigs.
On the Broadway?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. We had to remake the wigs with cages on the inside and just hair on the outside.
Exactly. Because that's how they did it in the 18th century France.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, so you've been on the stage and you've been on the screen, big and small. Is it nerve-wracking to do live TV or are you just, it's another show?
Well, how do you get nervous about something that's one night when you're nowhere near that night? Ask me on the night. You know,
okay.
That's the thing. But I assume I'll be nervous. Why wouldn't I be? I mean, millions of people potentially are watching you do
but
it
when
right
you go
or wrong.
On, when you're on Broadway, you don't get nervous before every show.
You do, but your nerves are something you use, you know. And on Broadway, no matter what happens, you know you can go on. I mean, one night when the can opened, you know, I fell out of the can. I tripped and I actually fell out of the can and rode down the flight of stairs my rubber breasts, landing on the floor of the theater. And my daughter just said her next line, which was, "Mama, we're on national TV." And I looked up at the phony camera and said, "Great." And we went on with the show. You know, what's the difference? You know, we've had all kinds of crazy stuff happens on Broadway. But live television is live television. Something happens, you know. So that part. But that's, you know, I think that's where that old serenity prayer comes in.
Right.
The things you can control, the things you can't. What you can control is you prepare. What you can't control is life. As what Crichton would say, life will find a way.
Writer, actor, Broadway legend, Harvey Fierstein, thank you for joining us. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.